Afternoon, please be seated. This is Cafe Moda versus Palmo. If you wish to reserve any time, please so state.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'd like to try to save 5 minutes for rebuttal. This is a case that presents the discrete issue about whether a defendant who is negligent is severally liable as opposed to jointly and severally liable in a case where the other defendant acts intentionally. To talk about this case, I'd like to address the language of the statute. I'd like to address the interpretations that plaintiffs have and that the district court adopted. But I'd like to start at an unusual point, if the court pleases. And that's the legislative history. Although we don't usually turn first to the legislative history because the issue of the clarity of NRS 41.141 comes up so often, we'll wind up resorting to it. So I thought that might be a good place to start. It's clear from the legislative history of the 1987 adoption of our several and joint and several liability statute that it was the intent of the legislature to adopt several liability in all circumstances except for the five that are set out in subsection 5. Senator Sue Wagner on the floor of the Senate talked about how this is a statute that has parties pay only their own share. And in the committees, even the presidents of the NTLA talked about how, yes, this does get rid of the deep pocket rule. And I think that that's essentially what we're talking about here. What do we do in a situation where one defendant is 20% at fault and is negligent, and the other defendant is 80% at fault, as determined by the jury, but acted intentionally? And I submit that is the clear intent of the legislature in adopting 1987's NRS 41.141 that they be severally liable. And I think that, you know, it's interesting. Plaintiffs have compared the 87 adoption to the 73 version of the same statute. And that seems, with one exception that doesn't arise in this case, that does seem to be an appropriate comparison. And here's what this court said in Warren versus Blanchard in 1984 about that version of the statute. This court said that NRS 41.141 abolished joint and several liability among joint tortfeasors, substituting several proportional liability based on fault. One defendant who was among several found responsible for the plaintiff's damages would therefore be only held liable for the damages, quote, in proportion to his negligence. And that's the part of the statute that I want to rely on, the same part that this court relied on in 1984. You know, I think we're throwing around terms here that are so imprecise as to be misleading. We talk about how the district court said you can't compare negligence and intentional acts. You can't compare them. Well, first of all, you can. That's obvious under the restatement approach, restatement section 1 of apportionment of liability. You can compare different types of fault, whether you call it comparative fault, comparative responsibility, comparative causation. Juries are able to do it, and the jury was able to do it in this case. What we're looking at instead, and you know, the statute doesn't say anything different. It doesn't say you can't compare negligence and intentional acts. It doesn't even say that you compare negligence. What it says is, in subsection 4, where recovery is allowed against more than one defendant in such an action, except as otherwise provided in subsection 5, each defendant is severally liable to the plaintiff only for that portion of the judgment which represents the percentage of negligence attributable to that defendant. It doesn't say,
Your Honor. That takes you directly to section 5.
Yes, it does.
Subsection 5, and doesn't that make it irrelevant depending on how you read subsection 5?
It does. It certainly does. And what plaintiffs are contending is what only one state that I've seen in the country does. What they're saying is, looking at the five exceptions, several liability doesn't apply in an action based upon A, strict liability, B, an intentional tort, C, toxic torts, D, concerted acts, and E, an injury to any person based on a defective product.
Now, and in this case, the action as a particular claim was based upon intentional torting.
Well, I think action, and this court and I have debated many times what the word action means. I used to argue that action meant the entire case. And this court has corrected me.
That's how you try says, to educate that.
That's right.
And it did to us on a number of occasions.
Right, and apparently the court was correct. And it depends on the usage in the particular statute. And it does seem here clear that what we're talking about is in the action, it has to be the particular claim. Because you could have a number of different causes that would be involved in an injury in a particular case. Let me prove my point by talking about the other exception, the last exception. It says it doesn't apply to joint and several liability based upon E, an injury to a person from a product. Now, if what we're saying is that anytime, let's say I'm driving down the street and Justice Paragiri is driving down the street and there is a, due to my negligence and his negligence and a defect in my automobile, he is injured. Now, the claim against me is for negligence. It isn't against me for strict products liability for the defect in my car. The claim against the automobile manufacturer is based entirely on a different aspect, and it is based upon the defect in the product. Plaintiff's reading and the district court's reading would say that I would have to be jointly and severally liable because of the product, even if it's my product, even if it's your vehicle, because they're all involved. I think the problem with the plaintiff's reading of the statute is it turns everybody into concerted actors. If I'm negligent and there's an intentional tortfeasor, under their reading, I would have to be jointly and severally liable with the intentional tortfeasor, even though I'm only negligent. In that circumstance, we'd be treated as concerted actors. But concerted acts is a different subsection of the statute. Only Florida has adopted this statute, has adopted this approach to their wording, the same wording in their statute. And I think the reason for that is that Florida was approaching this from a different premise. They were looking, in Buck versus Greyhound, this court did almost the same thing. This court interpreted the 1973 version of 41.141 and said, look, we don't have any legislative history. We don't know how to construe it, and we're going to construe it in favor of the pre-existing common law joint and several liability. That's what Florida did. Florida looked and interpreted their statute based on their own idea of judge-made law and how they wanted to interpret that statute. This is why I started with the legislative history. It is clear that the legislature wanted to limit exposure to several liability, wanted to limit it to fair share, or as we say under Chapter 17, equitable share. It's clear they wanted to get rid of the deep pocket rule. And that's why this needs to be interpreted this way. I've set out, yes, Florida goes against me. And the restatement, Section 14, goes against me for the same reason that they start with the viewpoint that they don't want a minimally negligent defendant to pay only his fair share.
That's your operative word, negligent.
Yes, but Your Honor, here's I think the reason why the statute uses the word negligent is because it only benefits people who are negligent. The jury can apportion responsibility among an intentional tortfeasor, a negligent plaintiff, and a negligent defendant. Now, who takes advantage of that? According to the wording of subsection 4, only the defendant who is negligent, because the statute says that I'm liable in proportion to my negligence. The intentionally acting defendant doesn't have negligence. He is absolutely jointly and severally liable. There's no doubt about that. He first of all, falls under an exception in subsection 5, but I would say even if subsection 5 weren't there, because of the wording of subsection 4, which says I am liable in proportion to my negligence, since his liability isn't based on negligence, he doesn't take advantage of that. Let me address two quick points before I sit down and save the rest of my time for rebuttal. This is not a Buck versus Greyhound case. In Buck versus Greyhound, this court interpreted what in such a case means. Mr. Koning conceded in the district court, and I commend him on his forthrightness throughout this entire case. He said, no, It is a bona fide issue in this case whether the plaintiff was comparatively at fault. So we're looking at a Buck versus Greyhound situation. 41.141 does apply, except for his interpretation. And secondly, let me say the NTLA didn't walk away with nothing in the 1987 adoption of 41.141. It's limited. The statute is limited in its applications to parties remaining in the action at trial. So if this were a case where plaintiff was suing Cafe Moda and we could never find the assailant, or if they had never sued the assailant, or if they had settled in good faith with the assailant, the issue simply would not be presented. So it's presented in the circumstances where we go to trial against the intentional actor and the negligent actor. And I'd like to save the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Before your hypothetical of the collision with Justice Perrigary's vehicle, you are severally liable, and whatever vehicle you own, that manufacturer is jointly and severally liable
for the entire amount, just as in this case Matt Richards is jointly and severally liable for the entire 100%. Thank you.
Mr. Poulsenberg, before you sit down, any consideration that the court should give as to the possibly adopting a duty to protect exception?
I don't think it's in front of the court. Now, this was not an issue that was directly raised in the district court. The way it was raised in the district court is in a paragraph that talked about what other states do. They quoted section 14 of the restatement. And they quoted it as an example of what other courts could do and word their statutes that way. Nevada has not worded its statute that way. I don't think you can read our statute the way the restatement section is worded. You'd have to start with the premise that you want to reach that result. And I don't think you can reach that. Maybe if we were back in 1989 and deciding Buck versus Greyhound and didn't have a legislative history, maybe then we could. I submit you can't because of the wording of the statute. But clearly we have a legislative history that makes clear that the intent is to get rid of joint and several liability.
Whose idea was it to go back to the jury for this second verdict?
It was mine. In fact,
I thought it was, I guess, obviously you joined in it, counsel,
yes,
is that right? I just thought it was a very creative and commendable idea.
In fact, I had asked
it
Justice...
It helped looking at the case.
It does, doesn't it? I had asked Judge Vega to do that before, and she had said no. I had run a writ petition to this court and said, look, you don't have to decide the issue, but at least tell her to submit the issue to the jury. The last day of that trial, I said, why don't we do it just to avoid another trial? And Mr. Koenig agreed. He made clear he didn't waive any issue.
Oh, no, of course not.
That's why I say I do like working with
you. I just wanted to commend the counsel because I thought it was a smart thing to do.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Koenig?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. I'd like to just introduce, this is the respondent, the plaintiff in this case, Donnie Palma, and it's his friend Chris Christie sitting next to him there. I want to start out with what the language says. In my first comment, I need to say to you, and although Mr. Poulsenberg did not raise this, it was mentioned a time or two in the appellant brief about the evil of joint and several liability. And I think this court understands that joint and several liability was the common law, and the basis was that it was better that in multiple defendant situations, it was better that a plaintiff get full recompense rather than not. So joint and several liability is not an evil that the legislature was trying to get rid of. They were making a social decision at the time they were enacting these comparative negligence statutes, trying to decide how best to change that policy. And before we even get to the 1987 and then the minor 1989 amendment to that statute, you have to look at what the clear language of the statute says. And it very clearly says that in the first paragraph there, that in an action to recover damages, that only negligence or gross negligence was to be compared. Those are the only elements, even originally from 1973 up to the present time, the only elements that would be the words that you find in the statute that would be compared, negligence and gross negligence. There was never any thought at the time the statute was first enacted that there be any comparison of negligence or gross negligence with intentional torts or even with strict liability. And then we have the subsequent two cases, the strict liability case that came before the court, Young's Machine versus Long, and then you had the willful and wanton argument in Davies and Butler. And this Supreme Court said very clearly that the comparison, the term negligence and gross negligence, those were the only types of actions that were to be compared. Not willful and wanton acts, not strict product liability or product liability actions. Our legislature was aware of that language. They were aware of those cases when they enacted the revisions in 87 and 89, and they didn't change the language at all in that. And then as you read down to Section 2, it talks about the very first words in Section 2 as in those cases, referring back to the negligence and the gross negligence comparison. And that goes also in Section 3, if a defendant in such an action, referring back to the negligence, gross negligence comparison. And then even when we get to Section 4 and Section 5, it still refers back to the first paragraph where it talks about comparing negligence and gross negligence only. Now, in 1987, Mr. Pulzenberg is right. There was tort reform going on at the time. If you read the notes and comments, medical malpractice was also involved. But there was a focus, the only conversation in the minutes that I read about comparing negligence with an intentional act, and it wasn't an intentional act, but it talked about strict liability. The researcher who was giving the presentation to the legislatures was talking about strict liability, and he said, I don't know how the court would respond if we had a strict liability action trying to allocate fault with a negligent action. And as you know, in products liability, you have negligence, breach of warranty, and strict liability claims. And the legislature obviously looked at this issue about allocating fault between not intentional tortfeasors, but between product liability and negligence. Because in Section 5, when they talk about their exceptions, there are basically A is strict liability, and the last one there, C, talks about an injury to any person or property resulting from a product, which is manufactured, distributed, etc. So you can see the legislature only gave consideration to this allocation of fault between negligence, and in this case, strict liability, under the products liability section. There was absolutely no discussion, no concern whatsoever about the issue that we're presented here with today, about the intentional tort of one of the multiple defendants. This statute has been on the books in its present form for over 20 years now. This court has had numerous cases in front of it, reported cases that I'm aware of, in which this duty to protect, type of a case which we have here has been before the court. Not once has this issue ever been raised, as far as I know, and whether it's been unpublished report, I have no idea. Nevertheless, this court has said that there is a strong public policy in this state requiring a property owner to protect one of its patrons from the intentional acts, the wrongful intentional acts of a third party. And that's where that duty to protect comes in. You asked about that concept, which we find in Restatement Torts Section 14. And Mr. Pulzenberger said, well, that wasn't raised in the trial court. Well, the reason it wasn't raised specifically is because the judge had already ruled in her response to a previous summary judgment that there would not be any allocation between a fault between a negligent and intentional tortfeasor. And she continued with that ruling throughout the trial. And I'll give Mr. Pulzenberg and the defendant credit because they kept bringing it up numerous times. Summary judgment, jury instructions, motions, throughout the course of the trial. So I'll give him credit for that. But it is an issue to be considered by this court, this duty to protect. When you look at all the vast cases that the appellant has cited in its brief and all of the treatises that are cited, you will find that the jurisdictions around this country who were cited in support of this proposition of comparing intentional conduct with negligent conduct, their statutes are so entirely different than Nevada statute. And those statutes in the other states, without fail, talk about how you can compare the fault of all of the potential responsible parties. And I'm not going to go through each and every one of the statutes that were referred to in the appellate brief, but every one of those statutes, not one of them, is similar to Nevada's concept of negligence and gross negligence comparison. It would have been very easy, and it will be very easy, if our legislature decides to apply several liability, to allocate fault, as the appellant wants. They can very clearly change and amend the statute, but they haven't done so as of this date. And there were cases, in reading the 1987 minutes, you know, they research cases across the country, and I don't know, and they're in the minutes, it doesn't say what cases or what jurisdictions they looked at. But this concept of trying to allocate fault between an intentional and a negligent tortfeasor has been around for a while, relatively recently in the long history of the law, but still for over 30 years or so. And our legislature has not done anything to clarify just how they want to address this issue. This is an issue that does indeed create or present significant issues of public policy. And again, if you read the Restatement Torts Third, it sets forth some of these policies, you know, or whether or not you reduce the incentive for a property owner to, you know, be reasonable or to try to protect the individuals from intentional acts of tortfeasors. And those things are best, in my opinion, addressed by the legislature, so we get a full, fair hearing in front of the legislature, and they didn't do that. So I can't say, and I can't agree with the appellant, that it was the intent of the legislature in 1987 to allow an allocation of fault between intentional and negligent tortfeasors.
Well, it was pointed out in the briefs that, going back to policy reasons and statements made in the legislative session when this was being discussed, Bill Bradley, then the NTLA president, indicated that the statute was designed to prevent the deep pocket doctrine. What do you think he meant by that?
Well, it's the same language that was used generally when they first enacted the comparative in 1973. But
when they first enacted comparative negligence, it was in an effort to alleviate the harsh results of contributory negligence barring all recovery. So that's what that was intended. My recollection.
As I recall, though, in 1973, they still had the paragraph where there'd be several liability if there were multiple defenders or defendants. So the whole concept and the mindset of not only our NTLA or the lawyers in front of the legislature, their mind was on, in this case, in 1987, basically negligence and strict liability. And they threw in intentional acts. They threw it in there as just a word. There was no discussion, nothing in the minutes that talked about comparing, you know, intentional with negligent. But because the law of negligence, gross negligence, had gone on for so long, I believe that's where everybody's mindset was. Nobody even considered this type of a situation, especially when you have duty to protect, which our court is for years now enforced and set forth.
Mr. Koenig, were you done answering Justice Gregory's question?
I believe so.
Okay. Could you respond to the suggestion that the word action in subparagraph 4 refers to claim? And if so, how would that affect your approach to the statute?
Well, I don't think in paragraph 4 the word in an action has any different meaning than it does in paragraph 1, which says parties to the action. So you go back to paragraph 1, where they're talking only about comparing negligence and gross negligence between the plaintiff, a defendant, or multiple defendants, because you'll see that same word in the last part of that paragraph 1, negligence or gross negligence of the parties to the action when recovery is sought. So I don't see it has any different meaning than what we have in paragraph 1. and I would probably argue it probably means not a claim, but the entire lawsuit, all of the claims.
If the court were to view that differently, would that affect your interpretation of the statute?
Well, then I would jump to the argument that this is an action based upon an intentional tort because of the special duty to protect. This isn't just an intentional. When we're talking about car accidents and enhanced injuries from crashworthiness, basically those are cases, it's my understanding, where you can divide the injuries. You know, there's the, you're saying that, say, in an enhanced injury case, your injuries were enhanced because of defect, the product defect. And a lot of times you're able to distinguish what injuries were caused by the enhanced defect. There was a hypothetical put in the appellant's brief about the sharp edge of a desk, and if somebody accidentally, you know, ran into the desk and the desk owner was sued for negligence because it was a dangerous effect, and then as compared if somebody pushed the person into the desk, and then trying to say that that would make them jointly and severally liable. And those are apples and oranges there, because the act, the duty that the property owner has is not to keep a safe desk, but to, in that hypothetical, to prevent that third person from pushing, you know, the...
So the landowner essentially becomes the insurer of all those who walk into his premises.
Pardon me? No. I heard you correctly. Not an insurer. Is that what you asked?
Essentially, if they're 100% jointly and severally liable for any intentional tort that occurs on their premises because of a duty to protect, don't they become ultimately the insurers?
Not at all. In fact, this court just did a decision recently this year. Silver Nugget was the defendant, where you again defined the duty to protect, and you limited
it's a different
it,
statute.
You put some pretty strict interpretations of what foreseeability, the requirements of foreseeability. So we're not just talking about, quote, a negligence duty of foreseeability. That has to be foreseeable to almost the same type of intentional wrong. And the restatement torts recognize the difference in these types of cases. And it's not just a general, you know, intentional act. It's a duty to protect type of a case, not just an intentional. And it so in no way makes it one, you know, makes an insurer. But again, just to go back to the policy consideration, if we apply the statute as appellant wishes, basically you're forgiving that intentional tortfeasor is being forgiven 20% of the judgment. Never before has an intentional tortfeasor been allowed to reduce his liability by the liability of any other defendant. And that's the effect of this. And if the legislature wants to do that, then let them put it in clear and simple language. And they just have not done that. And to me, the clear language of this statute very clearly says we're only going to compare negligence and gross negligence. And the exceptions they tried to make, they put a little more time on the products liability one, as we saw, but there was no mention, no consideration whatsoever given to this intentional tort duty to protect type situation. So I'd submit that the district court's ruling was correct. And if this court feels that if the statute itself is not clear, I would ask the court to please, you know, indicate to the legislature that this is the type of situation the legislature needs to address rather than judicial ruling on. Thank you.
Any additional questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me address Mr. Koenig's last point first. I am not saying that an intentional tortfeasor gets a discount. It is clear that only negligent tortfeasors are entitled to several liability. And that is a distinction
that... Well, the intentional
that
tortfeasor in this case got a discount.
The intentional tortfeasor?
Mm-hmm.
No, he is 100% jointly and severally liable for the entire amount.
That's the judgment, not 80%.
That's right.
Okay.
And you know, the problem is the restatement tends to mush these two concepts together. When you compare negligence and intentional act. And that's why I was saying earlier that we use the word with such imprecision it becomes confusing. It's one thing to compare, and yes, Section 1 of the restatement says you can compare. It's another thing to allocate responsibility according to that percentage. And Section 4 says that a negligent tortfeasor is responsible only for his proportion. Subsection 5, and I would submit Subsection 4, says an intentional actor is 100% liable. A products manufacturer is 100% liable. Only when the claim is based on negligence is there a discount. So Mr. Richards is 100% liable, but Cafe Moda is 20% liable. Mr. Koenig talks about the evils of joint and several liability. You know, he has a point. And this court in Buck versus Greyhound does say there are harsh results either way. But here the legislature has balanced those social equities and has decided for several liability. I talked about the imprecision, and you can compare negligence and intentional acts. And Hawaii says you can do that even where their statute only says negligence. And New Jersey says that, and to a lesser degree, Arizona and Utah. And we set that out in our brief. Counsel says that admits that this issue was not raised in the district court. And I think that's important because Restatement Section 14 says that the claim would have to be based on a specific risk. And that record was never developed in this case. Because if you look at the jury instructions, 28 and around there, it talks about criminal act versus recklessness. It talks about foreseeable acts. It doesn't talk exclusively in terms of intentional acts. Should this be left to the legislature? No, because, you know, Mr. Koenig and I are old. And although I look older than he does, we used to argue this in the 80s. Well, we don't know what the legislature meant, so leave it to the legislature. We do here know what the legislature meant. Thank you very much, Ron.
We thank counsel for the arguments this day. This matter will stand submitted. Court's recess until tomorrow.